Today on Maine Calling, U.S. Congressman Jared Golden. Second District Representative Jared Golden is home in Maine for Congress's August recess. That recess started early after House Speaker Mike Johnson sent Congress home to avoid a vote on the Jeffrey Epstein files. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, Congressman Jared Golden is our guest, and we will ask him about that decision as well as many other issues in the news. What, if any, concessions would Golden support to end the war in Ukraine? Does he believe the U.S. military has a role in fighting Mexican drug cartels? What about the National Guard being called in to police Washington, D.C.? Also, Golden has been publicly critical of his own political party. We'll find out how he believes Democrats need to change. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible in part by Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure with 19 locations across the state, now open in Bangor and Waterville, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering health care, education, and support to islands and coastal Down East communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. U.S. Congressman Jared Golden represents Maine's 2nd District. He's with us today to share his thoughts on national and global events. You can join the conversation. You can ask a question of Congressman Golden by sending an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Representative Golden, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Good to be back. Can't remember how long it's been, but
yeah, I think since February, right? Yeah. So, hey, I wanted to ask you, obviously, about the news of the day. The President Trump and Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine are meeting today, and reports are that there might be discussion of ceding of territory, and I'm wondering where you stand on that.
Jennifer, I think where I stand on that is that it's not for me to decide whether or not there'll be any, you know, territory concessions or not. I'm not sure that the U.S. should have a hard yes or no position on that. It seems to me right now, why would we take anything, any part of that discussion off the table? The war's been going on for a long time. I think it's been in a near stalemate for a number of years. Neither side seems able to have any big breakthroughs. As a member of the Armed Services Committee, we've seen efforts by the Ukrainian military to take land back, not very successful over the last couple of years. So I think most people want to see the war end. Probably no one wants that more than the people of Ukraine, and I think they're going to have to drive the discussion about what is on or off the table as part of either a ceasefire or peace deal negotiations.
Mentioned you're a member of the Armed Services Committee and, of course, a veteran yourself. Do you believe the U.S. should provide security guarantees to Ukraine?
I have seen the reporting of the meeting up in Alaska between President Trump and Putin, where for the first time there was some acknowledgement from Russia that they might accept such a guarantee from the United States. I'm not ready to sign off on that yet. That's a pretty big responsibility for us to take for our own country, for our own citizens. Something similar to a guarantee like that we offer to our NATO allies is a pretty big deal, but I'm not going to say no yet at this point either. But I've not had much feedback since that meeting on Friday about what is actually being discussed.
All right. Well, speaking of global events, President Trump says he wants to use military force against the drug cartels in Mexico. What is your reaction to that idea?
I've actually co-sponsored legislation with Dan Crenshaw, who's from Texas, in the last Congress. Dan was the chair of a special commission that was looking at the drug cartels in Mexico specifically. And he invited me onto that. I took part in a number of pretty in-depth, very thoughtful hearings. And some of the recommendations that came out of that had to do with things like trade issues, issues of for instance, the de minimis trade policy, if you're familiar with this, it basically says if something's being imported into the country under a certain dollar threshold, it can get doesn't have to go through customs, essentially. It'll go into a bonded warehouse, like, I don't know, like a UPS facility or you know, something like that. And what we learned from testimony from law enforcement was that this was one of the ways that a lot of fentanyl was coming in, and the Mexican drug cartels used that particularly. So that one recommendation was to crack down on that. But another one was maybe Congress should allow for an authorization for the use of military force against Mexican drug cartels, very limited in nature. Perhaps drones, even the threat of drones, might impede their very bold operations that are just south of our border. And so I'm open to the discussion. I don't think that the Pentagon is likely to prioritize putting American troops on the ground in Mexico, and I don't think the American people really are in a rush for us to do so anywhere. That being said, there's no doubt that the drug cartels are a threat to the well-being of millions and millions of us here in the United States, mostly through their drug operations.
Could
the overdoses, the fentanyl, they're not going to stop. I can tell you that from the meetings we had. One of the most telling was a guy that came in to testify. He'd been a member of the drug cartels, had been sent to the United States, was running a drug ring in one of the major cities like Chicago area. And the message he had for us, he'd been arrested, was in federal prison, and was now cooperating with the federal government against the cartels. And his message was, the amount of money to be made is so great, so phenomenal, that they're not just going to go away. You're going to have to make them do it.
So you're open to some sort of strikes at this point?
Potentially. I think it would be good for Congress to be part of that discussion, not just
that was my follow-up
president.
Question,
yes.
Right. Does the president need congressional authorization to do so?
I mean, his point was that if we held cartels at risk in their own home base, that they would change their practices. It would make it much more difficult for them. They'd have to go underground, essentially. But needless to say, part of the point is the Mexican government and military and law enforcement is not successfully doing that themselves.
You're home a couple days early this summer because the House Speaker sent you home because he didn't want Congress to vote on the release of the Jeffrey Epstein files. What's your reaction to that?
I mean, this is like very, in some ways, very insider Washington, D.C. talk, Jennifer. But at the same time, it's very much in the interest of the American people, which is part of why we ended up leaving early. I don't see why we wouldn't just release the files. I have no problem with that. I had no problem with that in the past. When President Trump wasn't in the White House and was campaigning and saying we should, you know, release the Epstein files, I thought, sure, why not do that? Now he's in office, and I still hold that position. I think transparency, wherever we can push information out, is always in the best interest, particularly when there is a kind of like developed conspiracy theory or rumor, whatever it may be. If we can get that information out, why wouldn't we do so? So I'd be happy to vote for any of those resolutions that were being pushed forward or to support the decision by the administration to release the files. For whatever reason, they don't want to do that right now. But getting out of town, you know, in July, we left town like 2 days early. The speaker didn't think he could hold his coalition of House Republicans together, thought they were going to lose a vote, which would have put on the floor a resolution to say to the administration that the Congress thinks you should release the Epstein files, and I guess they thought that would be embarrassing. That's the insider baseball part is.
Yeah.
They thought they were going to lose the vote. They thought it would be like egg on the face of the president and Speaker Mike Johnson's ability to hold his party in strict kind of lockstep. So we cut out of town 2 or 3 days early.
Why the obsession with this story in Congress?
Well, I actually think that it's the American people who have been told repeatedly by many elected officials, to include the sitting president of the United States, that this was an issue they should pay attention to, that it was indicative of a cover-up on behalf of the wealthy and the powerful and the elite in this country. And now that they are in office, and they are suddenly doing a 180 and saying there's nothing to see here, that's not settling very well with many people across the country.
Speaking of insider baseball, I want to talk about your feelings about your own party. There was you were quoted in a Rolling Stone article, Time magazine article, that you believe the Democratic Party is as weak as you've ever seen it. Do you believe that still to be the case, and how does the Democratic Party need to change?
Well, I can tell you that when I first came into the United States Congress, there was about 33% of people in Maine 2nd District were enrolled in the Democratic Party. Today, that stands at 29%, and the trend continues in the downward trajectory. So that's just in Maine 2nd District. I have won 4 elections successfully, which I'm very proud of, representing the 2nd District. But I have overperformed the top of the Democratic Party ticket in each of those elections. And simultaneously, we've seen the number of state house seats that the Dems have down ballot coming out of CD2 also decrease by about 10 in the House and a handful of seats in the state Senate. And I think a lot of that has to do with the image of the party, not just in rural Maine, but across the country. And I said rural there, so I'll just double down on that. It's no secret that the Dem Party is no longer faring well or competing well in rural communities across the country. I don't have the statistics right top of mind, but I think it's fair to say that Bill Clinton won just over a majority of rural counties in America. And in the last election, the Democratic nominee won less than 10% of them. That's a pretty big change right there, and I think it tells you a lot about where we need to focus. That would be important for the country. I don't think single-party dominance of rural America or urban centers is really in the best interest of those communities. I think when both parties are competing in an area, that's good.
What do you think the Democratic Party needs to do to recapture the rural vote?
I get asked this all the time, and we don't have enough time, frankly, to dig into all of it. So I'll just try and give you a couple of thoughts. One is maybe we could change the party apparatus's idea of what makes for a good candidate for Congress and change our perception of what people in certain communities want in the form of representation, right? So I have heard people in my own party disparage a candidate for Congress on the basis that her resume was not sufficient to impress people such that they would want to vote for her to be in Congress. And what was the knock? It was that she had tried to start a business and failed, as if that wouldn't resonate with many people who've done that, gone through that, succeeded, maybe later failed, came up short, whatever it may be. It's a pretty common story and experience. And also, she was a waitress. And, and the disparaging part is, but she's just a waitress, right? I think a failure to see that might actually strongly resonate with people in that community that she was striving to represent is indicative of some kind of mindset that is
negative.
It's an elitist mindset.
Yeah.
Thank you for putting it out there like that. So, my colleagues and I looked at her and saw a very potentially exceptional candidate and great member of Congress who would bring the voice of many of the communities that she would have been representing, to the seat, and that's the kind of voice that we need, not just in Congress, but in the Democratic Party as well. I also think we need to appreciate that sometimes the little things on the economic front really matter a whole lot too, that it's not just big picture and Congress needs to solve all the problems, but that the littlest of details about, let's say, fishing or, whether or not a gadget that might help reduce emissions going on a diesel engine is in fact reducing more emissions than it is adding into the environment as a result, let's say, of like the supply chain that has to go into getting that gadget onto a diesel, operated, let's say, tractors out in the woods. This is like a story I'm telling you, like a conversation I have actually had with loggers here in Maine who have said, like, we actually think that this is driving up prices for us, this requirement for this new widget, and we suspect that it's ineffective in actually adding more emissions into the environment than it's taking out.
Mm.
Like, those types of details matter a lot. My colleagues and I in Congress who are from more rural parts of the country and are Democrats will often talk about paying attention to these sorts of details and then trying to do something about them. And frankly, we get a lot of eye rolls.
That's what I was going to ask you. Are your ideas being listened to? Do you think the leadership in the Democratic Party is reaching out to those of you who have won in purple or even red districts and said, and are they listening to your responses?
Well, no. Not very well, in my opinion. We can always do better at that. I want to go like a little deeper on that discussion about, requiring that a new product be added to, a tractor or a piece of logging equipment to reduce emissions. So I can picture that some of the people listening are saying, like, so what, Jared? Like, that is really important. Climate change is a real threat, and we should do things, that we can do to reduce emissions. And I agree with them, but I also think that we have to be a party, not just elected officials, but those who are just members of the party, who care about the details and showing that government can be efficient and effective, and that we don't want to spend money on ineffective outcomes. And so when loggers are saying, okay, yes, this reduces emissions a little bit coming off of, the operations of our equipment, but it takes a special kind of fuel, which isn't readily available, which is, resulting in long supply chains and sometimes causing work stoppages on our side. You're hitting us economically, but it's also questionable if you're even reducing emissions because of that long supply chain. And they actually want to know. Like, they're willing to work with us. I hear this from the lobstermen too, is like there's a willingness to work with people and with government on regulations to solve problems, but not if they aren't proven to be effective. Like, no one wants to sacrifice for nothing. And I think we should pay attention to those details and really care about it. And at a time when there is a big assault on many a federal agency and department and program, instead of just saying there's no problems with any of them and defending every penny that gets spent or every job that exists, I think we should acknowledge that there's been ineffectiveness out there and that that's not okay. And we should be a party who wants to show that we can get, sweat the small details and get it right and demand that the government get it right as well. And that we believe it's possible that it can.
We are speaking with Congressman Jared Golden. So many more questions I have for you, and I know our audience does as well. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are speaking today with 2nd District U.S. Representative Jared Golden. Join the conversation. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Representative Golden, before we go to call, so I have a couple more questions I do want to ask, things I want to ask you about before we go to so many listener questions. And one is a follow-up to what you were talking about representing loggers and fishermen. You've recently endorsed an extension of the moratorium on the right whale rules. And I'm wondering, I know that I assume that you also want to protect right whales. So what do we do then to protect right whales if we're going to continue the moratorium? Do you believe in subsidies, for example, for ropeless gear, stricter regulation enforcement of shipping lanes and ship speeds? What needs to happen?
Mm-hmm. So I think we have pushed for greater, kind of a harder light to be shined on the freight forwarding industry. That's not for nothing. A lot of the whale deaths over the last 6 years that I've been in Congress were ship strikes. And those are, I don't think I have to explain to people that that is almost always fatal, whereas interaction with fishing gear is not always and infrequently is not fatal. So if you're trying to reduce mortality, you'd think you would start with the most obvious, lowest hanging fruit, which is we've had a lot of ship strikes. Those whales are not going to survive that. We know that. The delegation got a 6-year freeze on the development of new regulations against the lobster fishery. It didn't get a lot of coverage that we also got money, which was set aside to gather more data and information about the migratory, changing migratory patterns of the right whale. Where are the food sources? Why are they showing up in places that they were not showing up, or showing up in places at different times of the year? I mean, they had a pretty well-established migration pattern, which has changed and has resulted in some of these higher mortality events that have taken place, at least in the 6 years I've been in Congress. So the government has struggled to have good data on this, either because of a lack of resources and certain challenges. For instance, they will tag a lot of whale populations, but they don't tag the right whale for fear of, as best I can understand it, causing an infection. Is there a way to figure out how to tag them? It has to do with their skin is different than, other marine mammal species. So is there other ways to do this? Can we use satellites? Can we use, AI predictive modeling to try and figure out if there is a new pattern to their migration that we just don't understand right now, et cetera, whatever it may be? More information would be a good thing. The take reduction process, this is something that the whole delegation was talking about over the last several months, was moving forward to develop new proposed regulations to go into place at the end of that 6-year period. And yet none of the data that will be gathered from the millions of dollars that we also put forward as part of that law we passed in December of 2022 is even available. It hasn't been gathered. And so I think part of the argument we're making is let's not spend millions of dollars to gather data that will not even be a part of the current process for talking about whether or not this fishery should be regulated differently than it currently is.
In light of this debate over right whales, do you support President Trump's proposed changes to the Endangered Species Act?
I have worked with some House Republicans to look at things in the Marine Mammal Protection Act and whether or not we need to make changes. For instance, there's nothing in that law that says that something called the precautionary principle should be used. That is purely a kind of theory that has been put to use by regulators who are working in federal agencies. And the precautionary principle says that if you can imagine the possibility that something could cause harm to an endangered species or marine male that is protected, then you would rule in the favor of precaution. The law doesn't actually call for that, and there's been many instances where you can see how this causes a lot of friction and tension between communities and species that we're trying to protect, and can cause decisions that are going to weigh against the community's economic interests, sometimes in very devastating ways. I've contemplated supporting that we actually be able to prove that harm will be experienced, not hypothesize that it could occur, as an example. So I didn't answer your question because I'm not fully aware of what President Trump is proposing when it comes to the ESA.
Okay. It is a loosening. I can't tell you the details off the top of my head either. We will go to Barb, who's calling from Trenton. Hi, Barb. Go ahead.
Yes, good morning, Representative Golden. Thanks for taking my question. I would like a little bit of clarification from you on Gaza. You have consistently supported U.S. military support for Israel's attacks on Gaza, where we're now seeing widespread malnutrition and famine, where more and more children are dying of starvation every day, and people are even being killed by Israeli forces when they line up for food aid. You have denied that what is happening there qualifies as a genocide. I'm wondering if you accept the United Nations definition of genocide, and what else would you need to see for you to qualify what is happening in Gaza as genocide?
Thank you. Well, I think it's important to note that I have supported, through our National Defense Authorization Act, that's an annual bill, and also our appropriations process, military aid that goes to Israel. That's longstanding aid that's been in place, I think it'd probably be fair to say, for most of my lifetime. Through those same bills, I've also supported humanitarian assistance for people in Gaza, to include food aid and other forms of humanitarian assistance. I think where we disagree is what is happening on the ground and why and who is responsible for it. Just in the last few days, I have really paid attention to reports that it is well known by the UN agencies who are distributing aid that it is not actually a tactic of the government of Israel to try and starve people, which would be a genocidal act, but rather that a lot of the aid that is being distributed is being either given to Hamas or taken by Hamas or other armed elements within that society. And they are either selling it at exorbitant prices for profit, either because they're greedy or because they are selling it to then arm themselves to continue fighting with Israel, or they're using it as a tool of recruitment. If you join us and take up arms with us, you can have food for your family. I mean, this is actually well documented and not well covered in the media, nevertheless. And the very UN agencies that are distributing this food will not deny it when pressed about it. It's not part of their job description to fight against armed people who will take advantage of humanitarian assistance that's being distributed on the ground, I understand. They just are doing the best job that they can. And I think it's fair to say that they wish Israel would let more trucks per day in. I understand that. But I think we have to be real about why is the food not getting into the hands of the people that need it. And this is a problem that happens in every single war zone that I've seen across my adult life, whether it was when I was in the Marines or as a member of Congress. Wherever we have conflict, unfortunately, people suffer the most, innocent people suffer the most, and this is a perfect example of it. I agree with you that it's a terrible catastrophe.
Barb, thank you for your call. We'll go to Ash, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Ash. Go ahead.
Hi, Representative Jared Golden. So kind of going maybe off of that a little bit, but I'm just wondering if you could clarify how the Stop Foreign Funds Act would be enforced, and if you could shed light on how you would ensure fidelity with that, and if you could also shed light on any foreign monies that you receive, maybe particularly from AIPAC. Thank you.
Ash is talking about the measure to stop foreign funds in elections.
Yeah, I believe that the Stop Foreign Funds Act is seeking to close a loophole in our election system by which foreign money is often spent on referendum questions here in the United States of America. This is actually very near and dear to Maine since we recently passed a voter-approved referendum to say that we didn't want foreign money to be allowed to be spent in referendum here in Maine. Of course, this grew out of big energy debates that are, you know, this is a very local issue, but it's actually a nationwide problem. So the federal law says that you cannot have foreign contributions coming into any campaign for federal office, state office, or I believe that's probably true of local offices as well, like City Hall. But for some reason, there is some perceived loophole or question about whether or not this applies to referendum. So my bill would seek to just tell the courts, in fact, that this principle of no foreign money being spent in our election system should also apply to referendum across all 50 states. That's been challenged in the courts. I think the courts are wrong. So I'd like to pass a law to clarify that, and Congress is capable of doing that if we only had the votes. You tried to tie this to AIPAC at the end. I will just say that every single American citizen has a right to express themselves politically in the form of political activity, to include making donations as long as they are of a legal contribution limit and reported to any candidate they want, whether you do so as a Jewish American who supports the American relationship with Israel, or you do so as a strong supporter of protecting our climate and give through the League of Conservation Voters Portal or Emily's List because you want to support candidates for Congress who will stand up for women's rights. All of those forms of political activity and giving are exactly the same and are protected, constitutionally protected, and purely legal.
Ash, thank you for your question. An email from Claire. So many of us in the 2nd District are horrified by the increase in authoritarianism under the Trump administration, abductions and deportations of people without due process, military troops on our streets, attempts to limit voting rights, etc. But I have not heard one word from Representative Golden about these unconstitutional actions. Here's your opportunity, Representative Golden.
I usually deal with specifics. It's a pretty general statement. But I guess we could start with L.A. I don't think that the courts have found it to have been purely unconstitutional. There's been some process debates about the limits of the president's authority. And then again, there's the question that just because you can doesn't mean that you should. That being said, I think that there was chaos and violence in L.A. I think that there were elements pushing the protests in downtown L.A. who clearly wanted to use violence to make a point. Some of them even have questionable objectives. If you just, that kind of infamous picture or video of the guy waving the Mexican flag. So, look, I think that we have to crack down on that type of protest. That's illegitimate protest. We don't condone or support violence in protest. Law enforcement in L.A. themselves were divided about whether or not they supported having federal assistance. And I don't think that anything that was done was strictly illegal or unconstitutional, although I'm not sure that it was necessary. Open question if L.A. is very big and I think professional law enforcement agency could not have dealt with it themselves. But
what about not Los Angeles? But one of the things Claire says is military troops on our streets. What about what's going on in Washington, D.C., National Guard troops?
Yeah, I just said something about that the other day. And I have a high degree of respect for the D.C. Metropolitan Police Force. I also have a lot of respect for our Capitol Police, and I've also seen the National Guard from that region holding security in the United States Capitol for weeks on end after January 6th of 2021. All three of those entities have my respect and trust. I think they are professional. They're used to working together, and even the mayor of D.C. has, I think, expressed her desire that D.C. remain in control, but not objected to having the National Guard on the ground. There have been questions about who they should be reporting to and taking their orders from, but even the mayor of D.C. has not been 100% in objection to what's being done, and I think that they just announced that they had some kind of deal about how things are going to proceed in a cooperative way. There's no doubt that crime is down in D.C., but like, what is your baseline? I know of three people who've been caught up in drive-by shootings in the 6 years that I've been living there, and of at least two who have been carjacked. So I don't think anyone's for that. And that's to include the D.C. police force, the Capitol Police, and the National Guard folks that are going to be working with them on the ground.
All right. Well, we are speaking with Representative, 2nd District Representative Jared Golden. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and my guest today is Congressman Jared Golden. You have time, if you are quick, to send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. You could also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. A quick email from Debbie responding to what we were talking about earlier about the Democratic Party. She says, the Democratic Party has a former waitress in Congress. AOC has become a real leader for working people and against the excesses of the current administration. Democrats certainly don't hold her prior experience against her, but the president and many of his party do. Please put the elitist label where it belongs on the GOP who support the billionaire class. Do you want to?
I mean, on the contrary, the Democratic establishment absolutely opposed Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They fought her entry into Congress tooth and nail, and she beat an establishment political leader. And only then did they welcome her existence in the United States Congress. And I think she would probably agree with that telling of the story. So they didn't inherently respect her status as a waitress until she made them.
And many, many of the emails and calls coming in are about Israel. And I'll go to this one as a representative one. This is from Peter. You sit on the House Armed Services Committee. The U.S. is spending lots of our tax money supporting the current Israeli government. That government is now beholden to religious extremists committed to ethnic cleansing in the West Bank and Gaza. What realistic vision do you see for ending this war? What leverage do we have to end this war?
I think that there is a lot less leverage at work than a lot of people imagine. Israel, unlike the situation it was in a long time ago when it was first founded, has a very healthy economy. One that could support its own, I believe, operations here in this conflict. I also think that if the United States was going to play the role of peacemaker between the Palestinian people and the people of Israel, we would have done so at some point over the last 40 to 50 years. Every administration claims that they will be the one that will bring these, you know, different camps into a place like Camp David and broker a peace deal. It is always centered around a two-state solution. Frankly, I am open-minded to a one-state, two-state, three-state, any state solution that could bring peace to the region. But I think that the major players are going to be the Israeli people and the Palestinian people and then the surrounding countries around them. I think some of the most hopeful developments that we have seen in my time in Congress has been the peace deals that have taken place where we have normalization or recognition between Israel and United Arab Emirates or other Muslim countries in the region. There were very exciting talks taking place between Israel and Saudi Arabia to normalize relationships and move towards peace. I think that would have been an absolute, just giant piece on the chessboard towards peace in the region. And I actually think that Iran and Hamas in part started the war with their October 7th attacks to end those talks between Saudi Arabia and Israel because they do not want to see normalization and peace in the region. They benefit most from conflict and the status quo. So I think that we can get the greatest ROI with supporting that type of diplomacy. Well, maybe stepping back and realizing that it's going to have to be the people on the ground in both these countries who are going to decide that they are best served by living together in peace.
We'll go to Brett calling from Hancock. Hi, Brett. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Hi, Congressman Golden. Thanks for hopping on today on the show. I 6 years ago, must have been, I walked around Calais shaking hands for your campaign and appreciate the change that came in the 2nd District then. Since then, there's some places where I've been pretty disappointed, and one is with the environment and our rivers. That kind of ties back to a question you answered earlier around foreign money influencing Maine politics, but also earlier that, the ESA and right whales. So yeah, I live in Hancock, but near me is a river in Ellsworth. It's a river that has a dam owned by Brookfield Power, which owns dam across. They own dams across the state. Those dams kill fish. They don't meet Maine water quality standards. You, through your office, advocated for infrastructure money to go to these dams, specifically in Ellsworth, which was an unlicensed dam that was being litigated by the power company, the foreign Canadian power company, and you just handed over taxpayer dollars so they could run that facility. Can you explain what the thinking was behind that? And again, thank you both for the show today.
Well, needless to say, if I supported an earmark for a community, it was advocated for by that community itself. No member of Congress is allowed to earmark money through the budget process anywhere without strong support either from the municipality that will be supporting it or from nonprofits who will be putting it to work. So I think the best answer, you know, to your question is let's start by having a conversation about why the town of Ellsworth requested that earmark why they think that that dam needs to stay in place. I'm going to guess that they think that it is either important to preventing flooding of certain areas and or that it's supporting jobs in the area. We saw a similar debate over in Skowhegan. Same company that owns the dams pretty much everywhere. But without it, if the dam were removed, yes, it might make passage of certain fish populations easier. But there are other ways to do that without removing a dam outright. But what would have been lost would have been thousands of jobs at the paper mill in Skowhegan, which the people of Skowhegan would not want to lose. And I don't blame them for that. And so I supported keeping that dam in place as well. But community support for an earmark is the number one, you know, first must-have box checked before we move forward in supporting something like that. Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Brett. We will go to Ron from Wittapitalock. Have I pronounced your town right, Ron?
Yeah, you did. Good job. I'm impressed. So, hey, Jared, just want to call in and thank you. I continue to appreciate your perspective, and I don't agree with everything you do by any means, nor do I with any person on the earth. But, just feels good to look at what you do, and you always seem to, to take off your D when you need to in order to do what's right for the people of Maine. And you seem to put us first, even though it doesn't always fit with what your party wants. And I think that's a true core Maine value that we've had in, some of our great politicians that we've had in Congress over the years. And you certainly are doing a good job for us. So I appreciate that and wanted to just say thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the call and the positive feedback.
Ron, thanks so much for your call. Congressman Golden, what is it that you're most concerned about right now in terms of your constituents and what they're facing, given all the changes coming from Washington?
Yep. Obviously, there's a lot that's been going on over the last 6 years or over the last year. And over how many months are we into 2025, seventh month here. I have tried to focus this year on the things where I thought I could have an impact. That concerns me most with what is actually coming to the House floor, what is being voted on, and what, if anything, can we stop through the legislative process. It's the earlier question, I think, that came from you about the weakness of the Democratic Party right now. Like, do I even have to make the case that is so? The last election went so poorly that we have a Republican president, a Republican-controlled Senate, and a Republican-controlled House. And so far, to their credit, they have held together and passed everything that they have set out to pass and push forward on their Republican agenda, some of which was promised and some of which wasn't not promised. In fact, I think the opposite of what was promised. But hats off to them. Like, they have been able to use their power in Congress without showing any fracturing in their coalition such that Democrats have leverage. And that has been what's most frustrating for me over the last few months that we were in session, you know, May, June, July, I really tried to weigh in with as many of my Republican colleagues that I have formed, you know, friendships with to say, you don't have to vote for this big party bill. I've done it myself. Like, you can break with your party leadership and say no, and you'll be okay. And in fact, I think you'll be rewarded by your constituents, whether they be Republicans or Democrats or unaffiliated with the two-party system. They're not going to be upset if you say no to deep, deep, deep Medicaid cuts that are going to hurt not just my state, but your own. And a lot of them were acknowledging that they had concerns. And yet at the end of the day, they all got to yes on what I thought was a terrible bill. You know, they call it the big, beautiful bill. I'm really concerned about what it means here in Maine. We've got a third of my population that I represent on Medicaid. I think it's fair to say that close to 70% of the people that go in the door of a hospital are on Medicare or Medicaid. The Medicaid cuts go far beyond work requirements, which is what the Republicans are really going to try and hide behind. It's going to force the Maine legislature to cut into Medicaid services and what they will put forward and pay for, which will reduce the federal match. We already have CEOs and CFOs of our hospitals saying that this is going to hurt the hospital system in Maine. I think we could expect, if they move forward, to see a couple of hospitals go under as a result, as well as a handful or more of nursing homes, which we've already been losing too many of both. This means less services available out there in our communities. And it's also going to mean more charity care, which really means if someone doesn't have insurance when they come in the door, the hospital system pays for it anyways. And then they raise their prices for all of us. So we'll see our premiums go up as a result. This bill also did not address the soon-to-be expiration of subsidies under the Affordable Care Act that were going to middle-class families. That was part of a law change that we pushed through in the last Congress or two Congresses ago to try and address what looked like a donut hole that was making it so that ACA subsidies or health care was pretty unaffordable for middle-class families. That's going away. We need a deal to fix that. The Republicans should have done it for themselves in this bill. We've got the cuts to food benefits right here. I mean, people are calling in about all these world issues. Well, we've got a lot of hungry people right here in Maine, and it's going to get worse because of the Republican agenda that's been passed into law this year. These are the things that are top of mind for me, as well as these more local issues that I've been pursuing for years in Congress for the fishermen I represent or farmers or loggers. But, I know that you'll hear that the bill makes it so there's no taxes on tips or Social Security. That's not true, actually. Like, it creates a tax credit when you file your taxes. I mean, we're actually worried about seniors being confused about this. The messaging that came out from the big, beautiful bill was there's no taxes on Social Security. Well, if that's your only form of income, you might think, well, then I don't have to file anything anymore. Well, in fact, you do, and you will be in trouble if you don't. Like, you have to file first, and then you might get a credit. But there's still a tax on Social Security in place in the law. They didn't make it tax-free. Same with tips. You still have to report your tips. They're still going to be taxed, and you'll get some sort of a refund on them, but it expires after 3 years. Meanwhile, the bill as a whole extended the 2017 tax cuts, which we know greatly benefited the wealthiest people in the country. And it blows a giant hole in our deficit, which I feel like I've established credibility to talk about as someone who has actually received awards from fiscally minded organizations for having a voting record that doesn't just talk the talk but walks the walk about my fears about our deficit and our debt. And this particular bill is adding another $4 trillion to our debt over 10 years. There's no way it's paying for itself. It's been disproven. And the country really couldn't afford it. So we're losing health care. We're seeing our deficit problems get worse as a nation, which will impact Maine and Mainers here. And I don't think big fiscal problems are that far down the road unless we do something about our deficit and debt. People are losing food assistance here in the state of Maine. And I'm not sure what we're getting for it other than big giant tax breaks for the very wealthiest people.
That's going to be the last word on this hour. Congressman Jared Golden, thank you so much for being my guest today. And we hope to have you back soon. Today's sound engineer, Sandra Harris. Main Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to speak with a teenaged author about her memoir, describing her family's roots in Ukraine and their journey and her experience living and growing up in Orono. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Main Calling on Maine Public Radio.